It's Iron Man matches and iron poor tired blood. It's the outdated wrestling hour. Welcome back, everybody. Welcome back, Halifax, Nova Scotia. And all of our listeners to the Outdated Wrestling Hour with Bob Smith. That's who I is. And I'm really, really glad to be back with a really special show. We have a special guest. His name is Eric Johnston. Just came out with a brand new book called Run with the Bull, Three Generations of Sports and Entertainment. Wrestling and comedy. And you're going to find out who his grandfather was and who his dad was. And how good is this book? We'll just put it this way. Greg Oliver had a lot to do with it. And if you know who Greg Oliver is, you're listening to the right show. And after this show, you're going to want to know who Eric Johnston is. I'll tell you that much. So in any event, we're going to do our usual commercial announcements and we will get right into the action here, so to speak. Step in the ring with us. We'll be right back after these very important words.
Ladies and gentlemen, Wrestling Fans International Association is back. That's right, the premier fan club association of the 1970s and 1980s has been revived and is back in business. Join today. It's free at thewfia.org. That's thewfia.org. You can also join us on Facebook at facebook.com/groups/WFIA1969.
Well, everybody, I've been looking forward to this one for a while. This one's different. This was really different, and that's what I like about this. You all know Greg Oliver, who's one of the most prolific wrestling book authors in the world. He has just released, on his label, I guess, a book called Run with Bull, Three Generations of Sports and Entertainment. Now, what does that mean? Well, if you go back as far as I do, you may remember a professional wrestler named Bull Johnson. He was all over television in various federations in the 1970s, and he went on to have a son called Danny Bullwhip Johnson, who went on to have a son who is our guest, Eric Johnston. And I'll tell you what, this is three generations of some very interesting wrestlers and a very interesting person I'm about to speak with. Let's introduce him and we'll get talking. This is Eric Johnston. Eric, thanks for being on the Outdated Wrestling Hour with this old fart. How you doing?
Well, you know what? I appreciate that you're an old fart because there's not a lot of people who either saw or even knew who my grandfather was when he was working. So the fact that you know that makes me appreciate you for everything that you've seen and all the places you've been, and here we are now.
Well, as you know, I worked for Pro Wrestling Illustrated and a lot of the magazines in the 80s and 90s, and I remember very vividly your granddad, Bull Johnson, who I believe was also announced in my TV watching days as Bull Johnston with the T.
Yes.
I think I'm right about that. Am I right?
No, I think you're definitely right. I think what happens was is the name, like the actual government last name is Johnston with a T.
Right.
You know, I'm Eric Johnston with a T. But, you know, both my dad and my grandfather, I think whatever, it was just, you know, there was no quick edits in a poster back then. So, you know, some promoter would say Johnson, the next one would say Johnston, and the same guys would show up. You know what I mean? Like, it would be whether Johnston was booked or Johnson was booked, my grandfather was there to get paid. And I just don't think they cared enough. I don't think they had a big enough ego. I think more so in the States, down in America where you are, it was more Johnson, no tea.
Right.
I think when it was up in the Canadian circuit, there's a big, a love for the English language in Canada on the CBC. And, we want some proper pronunciation, and that would be the T. So I think it was more so in Canada that they allowed the T to come in. It's so funny. Greg and all, we won't bury the lead here, but as Greg and I were doing the research for this book, Run With The Bull, it was, there was so many different variations of every name and every gimmick and every spelling. It was just so interesting to see.
Well, you know why wrestling promoters, like WWE now, does usually first names on wrestlers sometimes? Because they think the fans are dumb.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, I think, you couldn't have a name like Bartholomew, Stephanopoulos or anything like that, because they think the fans won't remember it.
Yes, of course.
There's Gunta. Everything is just one word with them because they think the fans are, dumb. But I don't agree with that. I think if you're good at what you do, they'll remember you. And I remember your granddad. I saw him on television a lot.
Yeah.
Now, there was one match that pissed me off.
Go on.
It wasn't him, because he had a very unique style. He was big, but also like really supple in the ring. I don't know if that makes any sense to you. Like, he had arms and legs everywhere.
Yeah.
He was big, but not, I wouldn't say he was like a power guy, but he was big enough to be strong. He was your traditional 1970s bad guy is what he was.
Yeah.
And I saw a match from the old IWA, and this may still be floating around on videotape somewhere, where your granddad, Bill Johnston, and a guy named Joe Manning took on Louis Martinez and Argentina Apollo from the old IWA. Now, I don't know if that match rings a bell.
I've seen it on YouTube, and I don't think it's, I think it's no longer available on YouTube, but I often type in Bull Johnson wrestler, Bullwhip Johnson wrestler, and I dig through as much stuff as I can find, and I do know the match you're referring to, because I remember that Louis Martinez was not wearing shoes. He was not wearing boots, and I remember
that's actually Argentina Apollo was the
okay
one.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
But here's what cheesed me off about that match. Okay, now your dad and this guy Joe Manning, who I never saw before or since, but the fact is they weren't cheating all that much. But near the end of the match, I guess they had a special guest referee who was some old local celebrity or something. Mm-hmm. And near the end of the match, that referee was belting the two so-called bad guys, your dad and his partner.
My grandfather, you mean? This is Bull Johnson?
Yeah, Bull Johnson.
Yeah,
He was hitting the bad guy team. Like, that's not right. I'm sitting at home. I'm probably 17 years old at that point going, that isn't correct. What the hell is this? I thought it was a farce. So, and you know what? Even Jack Reynolds, the announcer, said, the referee showboating a lot here. And I'm like, yeah, a little bit, I'd say. Yeah, he just smacked the guy in the mouth. So, you remember that match? Did you ever see it?
You know what? They must have wrestled like that a few times. I don't remember the ref getting involved, but I do remember how simple the spots were. You know,
right.
in one of the tag matches, what the final, one of the final moves is not the finish, but it's one of the final moves is just my grandpa Bull just goes over the top rope and lands on the ground. Mm-hmm. And that was oh my goodness. He's gone over the top and he's landed it on the ground. And there's another part where my grandpa Bull pulls someone over and hits them with the bell, the ring announcing bell. And at that time, oh my, that was unheard of. It was
right.
How barbaric of him to do that. Now that's just a regular match. It's just a regular spot. You know what I mean? And most matches these days.
Well, you know what made Bull Johnson interesting? He was a heel that could make the crowd laugh.
Yes.
With that?
Oh, I wholeheartedly agree with that. Both my grandfather, Bull Johnson, my father, Bullwhip Johnson, they were heels, but they were funny heels. I remember the audience killing themselves laughing when I was going to watch my dad's matches in the 90s. And, I think that was part of their charm. My dad did a lot of walking and talking before he got in the ring, but it was almost like he was, in today's, comedic words, he was doing crowd work. You know what I mean? He was finding out about people in the audience and making fun of people in the audience. And he was kind of like a roast comedian. My dad loved comedy. My dad loved, you know, Dean Martin celebrity roasts and stuff like that. And I think that's what part of his dream that he was actualizing in his heelness is roasting the audience and walking and talking. And I know that my grandfather was the exact same way, because I've seen it in video, you know, on the old tapes out of Chicago and Detroit and Pittsburgh and stuff like that. It was very walkie-talkie and very funny. And I mean, now I'm a professional touring stand-up comedian. So, I mean, that, it makes perfect sense. Yeah.
And by the way, I'm not burying my lead here. I want people to know about Eric. And I'm going to use the third part of our conversation to talk about your career, because I've seen the pictures in your book, and you don't get to hobnob with people like you do if you're not really doggone good. And I think we're talking to one of the hot comedy stars coming up through the Great White North into our midst. So we'll talk about comedy to end this particular interview. But anyway, yeah, I'll tell you something else about Bull, because I was kind of I liked watching him work, to be honest with you.
Yeah, he's built like a fire hydrant, as we said. Was, book, you know,
when he got frustrated, he was very funny.
Yes.
Like, he would complain to the referees, and in such a way, the crowd would get into him, even though they were rooting for the other guys. And that's a skill, man. He was a very, very unique in-ring persona. And from reading your book, I understand he was just as unique outside the ring, too. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I never met my Grandpa Bull, which is crazy to even think of. I feel like I've lived this whole life with him. But unfortunately, he passed away in 1988, and I was born in 1990. Okay. And so everything I've learned about my grandfather, you know, I've learned through story. And that's what we've done with the book. And that's what Greg Oliver's gone out and interviewed all the old wrestlers and found the old, you know, magazines and clippings and, you know, historical records and other books where my Grandpa Bull is mentioned. I say I was formally introduced to my own grandfather while writing this book. And there are so many stories about him as a wrestler, but there's even more stories about just what a character he was. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, he's always stealing something, and he's always trying to make a living, and he was always trying to make a buck. And, you know, he'd always be falling asleep while he was driving. And then there's a whole chapter in the book called The Sleep at the Wheel of all the different road stories of him. And there was, there's a theory that he had undiagnosed narcolepsy. And also, he was a drinker. So you put those two worlds together, the guy was sleeping all the time. And, you know, I think the biggest thing that I got, that I learned about my grandfather while doing this book with Greg and his assistant, Joe Cacciaro, was that, you know, not only what a character he was, but what a hard worker he was, both inside and outside the ring. That's what I admire so much about my grandfather. I learned so much about him in this book, is, you know, he was always trying to make a buck. And I think for him, wrestling was just another one of his many jobs. You know, he was a steel worker, a truck driver, the guy, you know, shoveled manure. He was a scrap metal dealer and a shinny man and a repairman and also a professional wrestler. And that was kind of the story of the coming out of the 50s, 60s, and 70s of professional wrestling, which I find so, so interesting.
It is. And I'll tell you something else, too. I know I've gotten to know through this podcast a wonderful lady named Paige Von Hess Sutherland, mm-hmm. who is the daughter of Kurt Von Hess, who has nothing but glowing things to say about your granddad.
Yeah, yeah, no, she loved my entire family. I just saw Paige. Paige is in the book, a couple quotes from Paige in the book, and I just saw her at a wrestling event and got her a book and signed her a book, and she's always such a great supporter of my family and loved my Grandpa Bull, because she was, you know, a teenager when he was, you know, around with her dad. And mm-hmm. and then when my dad, you know, got into the business himself and moved down to, you know, they were in Baton Rouge together, and Kurt and my dad had a place in Oklahoma and Louisiana, and she was again like a teenager and down there around all the time, my family. You know, she's got more stories about my grandfather than I ever have, because she was there, which is so crazy.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
I am so glad, though, that there's people like her, and to be honest with you, me, who remember your grandfather at this point, especially since this book is coming out now. And I knew exactly who he was. In fact, when Greg brought him up, Bull Johnson, on my show when I interviewed him recently, I went, "You're doing a book on Bull Johnson?" I was excited. I really was, because that was part of my youth, man. I watched him when I was just about 16, 17 years old, and I knew who he was. He was all over the place. Yeah. And that's a testament to how good he was in the wrestling ring, because he worked everywhere, man. He was every place.
Yeah, you know what? I think it was not just his work ethic, but I think people just like being around him. You know, promoters like working with him because he was funny. He was a leader in the dressing room. He was a friend to everybody. He told great stories. He could drink like an animal. You know, he just one of those guys that people wanted to be around. That's why if you look at his booking schedule from the 70s, the 60s and the 70s, he'd go from Pittsburgh to Seattle to Oregon, back to New York State, back to Montana. Like he was all over the place by car, which is so crazy. I mean, I do it now. Again, we'll talk more about it later, but I do my tours by car. And I think to myself, I can't believe I do this. And then I learned all the places that my grandfather went. I go, of course I could do this. I mean, look at the men that I came from, these crazy road warriors that were always on the road in these old beaten up cars with three wheels on them.
Oh man, if you love it, you do it. I was a musician on the road for 15 years, and I remember bringing my band to Cincinnati for a one-nighter.
Oh yeah.
I mean, I was that from New York City. I was crazy.
Of course. Hey, we're crazy. All crazy.
You lose your mind.
We can never explain it. We can never explain why we do what we do.
One word, passion.
That's right. And love.
Love to do it.
Yeah.
Love nothing more than doing it. And that's why you do it.
Yeah.
So, you know, no other word fits. It's just a passion for it.
Yeah. Maybe crazy. Crazy may fit.
Yeah, crazy. So also the book is there's some great stories about your granddad from Reggie Love, who was with the famous tag team Hartford and Reginald Love, the Love Brothers, whose gimmick was simply that they were hippies.
Yeah. Which cracks
me up all the time. I am telling you, I don't know if you ever saw them, but they would get heat from getting into the ring. Pardon me, I'm laughing. They would get heat from getting into the ring just by putting a peace flag banner over the ring ropes and standing there and smiling. Boo. Yeah. I laughed every time.
You know, it's always something because, you know, wrestling is a microscope into what's going on around the world in society. Now, if you look at the timelines of it, you know, the free 60s, the hippie 60s, you know, that's when people hated hippies. You know what I mean? So it was perfect. They would get so much heat because they'd be going to the middle America or working towns in America. You know, you've got guys coming out of the, you know, World War II and real, you know, buzz cut guys. And you got these two Love Brothers coming in, and they were just such natural heels just for being loving and caring and peace and happiness and smoking dope and kissing girls. And that would drive people crazy, which is funny.
You're so right. You just brought back a memory of me in the backseat of my family car. The family's going somewhere, and my dad sees a guy with long hair, and he goes, "Look at him. Look at him." Probably coming home from some goddamn pot party. And I'm like, "Oh my God, Dad, please." Right? I mean, that's how people thought back then.
Those goddamn hippies. Yeah, exactly.
Damn dirty hippies, right? Yeah. It's just, oh man. But anyway, I don't want to telegraph too much. It's in the book because I want people to go out and get
Run
with the Bull, because this is a heck of a book, folks. You're gonna laugh, you're gonna get choked up, you're gonna really be moved by this book, and it's well worth finding. And I know it's on Amazon and everywhere you buy books. So let's go from your granddad to your dad,
Bullwhip
Johnson. Now, before we start, I just realized that I was at Starrcade 90 in person.
Oh, wow.
In St. Louis. Yes. Bill Apter had come to me during the week. He says, "You want to go to St. Louis?" I was working with PWA at the time. You know, help me with my, camera gear and, you know, cover the matches with me. I said, "Sure." So we flew to St. Louis. And it was back in the days, we flew on a red eye into St. Louis the night before. And there were six people on the plane, if you can imagine.
Oh, wow. Probably smoking on the plane, too.
Yeah. And people, and then wait, the stewardess says, if you want to sleep, just grab a row and lay down. I never experienced anything like that before. So it was great. So anyway, we get to St. Louis and this card comes out. It's remembered as one of the most god awful WCW events of all time.
Oh,
but I want you to know your dad had nothing to do with that. Whoever criticized him for his match is full of it.
Okay? Yeah.
Absolutely full of it, because The whole card was a shambles. It was the payoff to the awful Black Scorpion angle and all this other stuff, and a bogus international tag team tournament where they just kind of threw guys in the ring that didn't even know each other and, you know, thrown together on the fly. And it was not the greatest show in the world. But your dad had nothing to do with that.
Well, thank you for saying that. You know, I struggle with that because, you know, and you've read it in the book, and I'm very open about it. And, you know, we do want people to read the book, but I will say that there is a chapter, you know, specifically about Starrcade 90 and how that really could have been my dad's big break. You know, I think in his mind, he thought this is it. You know, he started in 79. Or 78 as a, you know, in the business. And now this is 90, you know, I'm born in July. This is now December. And I think for him, he thought, okay, I'm 11 years into the business. I've already been to Japan. I've already been to Los Angeles. You know, I think it's now time for the big, you know, big promotions to know who I am. And he gets brought in on, God, one of the worst matches in the history of professional wrestling. It's hard for me to watch, really. And I talk about it openly in the book. And it's not really about how bad the match was, because listen, when you're a professional wrestler, you're on the road that many nights a year, they're not all going to be tens. Mm-hmm. But it was the way that it was kind of set up for him to fail. And the worst part about it is, you know, my dad, professional wrestler, is ready to work with these guys, and he's wrestling two Olympic shoot wrestlers who don't know how to work at all. And, you know, that led to what a disaster was. It led up to, you know, to some of the worst, you know, tie-ups and cross bodies, and that belly-to-belly suplex. That guy almost dropped my dad, all 275 of them, on his neck. He could have been paralyzed, could have killed him. You know, so in that way, I look at it as, you know, in anger. But I wrote in the book, you know, my dad survived in spite of it. You know, he came home and he still had to be a dad, and he still was a working professional wrestler. And yeah, the phone stopped ringing for a bit, because that's a rough gig to shake off. But, you know, it was just such I've never met anyone who was there. And I always was curious what my dad's reaction was backstage, because I remember I can just feel that he's just thinking, like, this was my shot. And they fucked it up. And how am I going to get out of here? You know what I mean? And that's kind of the way I look at it. You know, I'm always curious.
One match doesn't make a career, though. You know, I was in
the
business. It's like, first of all, it wasn't all that long. Secondly, the card itself wasn't memorable.
Mm-hmm.
The whole concept of the tag team tournament was just bogus. It just didn't work. I don't even remember who won. Was it the Steiners? I don't even remember.
I don't even know. Yeah.
So I was there, and I wasn't thrilled by it. I was happy to be attending an event at the, you know, Kiel Auditorium. You know,
yeah.
First time I'd ever been there. But so I felt the history in the building, and I'm thinking, you know, they did magic tricks earlier with this Black Scorpion and all this other stuff. I'm like, oh, get this. I want this over with.
Yeah.
I didn't enjoy it. I really didn't enjoy that card. So, trust me, I did not walk out of that building saying that Bullwhip Johnson was the problem.
No, I appreciate that, and I hear that loud and clear. I think it was a booking disaster all in every right, not just the Pat O'Connor Memorial Tournament, just, you know, everything. So thank you for saying that. That actually does help heal me many, many years later, so thank you.
Well, I'm glad I can help in that regard, because you know something? There have been some great wrestlers that had bad nights.
Yeah.
And you know what? It wasn't his fault. If he's with a couple of shooters who don't know anything about pro wrestling, how good could it possibly be? Well, it certainly isn't the fault of the guys who are botching the moves.
Well, it's funny because I'm a stand-up comic, right? We were talking about it. It's like me being on a stage with I'm a stand-up comic, and they throw some guy from sketch comedy out there. And they go, yeah, okay, well, you guys are both funny. Go ahead. You know what I mean? And it goes, no, we do completely different things. I'm a stand-up comedian. I'm a storyteller. This guy's looking for, you know, improv from the audience. It's two different worlds, you know? And they go, okay, now you guys work together. So now, you know, I think of it like that, and I go, yeah, they're not at all the same. You know, it's very interesting when we reminisce.
It certainly is. And let's talk more about your dad. In his wrestling career, he did pretty good, didn't he? I mean, overall, considering where he came from, I don't think the association with his dad meant that much probably when he was starting, because, you know, people have short memories when it comes to pro wrestling. But I think he had a nice little career. Would you say that was the case?
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think if he was around today and you would ask him, and if he got to all the places he wanted to go, I think he would say yes and no. You know, I think he had a little bit of a leeway breaking in, you know, because my grandpa Mulligan was so respected that when my dad and my uncle Randy broke in together as the Sharp brothers, they were put over pretty heavily by Lou Thesz. And Lou pulled them out on Crybaby Canyon's Superstars of Wrestling show. And there's a video on YouTube when he goes, "Now these two boys, they're coming down the pike and they look like they're going to be the future stars of professional wrestling. And I'm happy to put my hands on these young boys and show them the ropes and show them around." And Crybaby goes, "Oh, what's your boys' names?" And they go, "Randy and Danny Sharp." And they're green as hell. They're maybe 18 years old. And I could tell that was a very prideful moment for both my dad and my uncle Randy to, you know, Lou Thesz, my God. And I think as my dad took off on his own and became Bullwhip, he broke out of the Sharp name, and then he was Danny Johnson, then he was Bull Johnson, then he was Danny Bull Johnson, then he was every name and gimmick. But I think once he found Bullwhip, which was somewhere mid 80s and into the 90s, you know, that was when he really, I feel like, that was his thing. You know, when I talk about him, I go, "That's my dad, Bullwhip Johnson." You know, I don't go, "That was my dad, Danny Sharp, aka Danny Bull Johnson, aka," you know, I go, "That's my dad, Bullwhip." You know, and that's how people remember him, at least in Hamilton and across Canada. I think, you know, he did everything you could do. I think he wrestled every territory. He wrestled Japan. He was down in Trinidad, working down there, and you know, down in Los Angeles. And, you know, he did the championship belts, tag team belts with Walter Johnson. And, you know, they had a good run there. I think, you know, my dad wanted to get to the top. I think, you know, it, like stand-up comedy and professional wrestling, you don't get in to end up somewhere in the middle. You know, you get in because you what you think and you want to get to the top. And I think my dad, towards the end of his career, once he realized that maybe that wasn't happening, I don't know he handled it very well, which, you know, led to a bunch of mental health and addiction and all his ultimate demise. But, you know, he did an interview with Greg when he was still alive. And Greg said, if you know, he says to Greg at the end of his interview, "You know, if I could do it all over again, I would." You know, I think my dad had a lot of fun out there, man. I think just like my grandpa, he was always on the road making people laugh. He was a good hang. People respected him. So, you know, I don't know how to answer that. I think he had a great career. And I think like every wrestler, you always want more and you never want it to finish. I mean, look at Flair. He's retired. How many times has that guy retired? You know, it's never over. Right. Until it's over, you know. So yeah, I think I look at my dad's career and I'm very proud of it. I hope that,
well, you know, you should be, and I'll tell you why. If in his later years he says, "I loved it," it's the same with me. My music career, I was on the road for 15 years until, you know, age said, "Just stop, it's over now." But I will say this, I don't regret a minute of that either. I had a blast. You know, some things are more important than money. If you have respect from your peers and you had a good time. Life's short, man. That's 2/3 of the prize right there, I think.
Yeah. I mean, for me on the road as a comic, you know, I just did another run in Northern Ontario and I'm making more right now in my career. I'm making more money than I ever have in my entire life. However, I got more expenses. I just bought a house and my wife and I are going through fertility treatments right now. So I got more expenses than I've ever had in my entire life right now. So life is about the same. But the point is I turned to my opening act in Northern Ontario. And I go, "It's so great that I could go into these towns, pretty much anywhere in North America at this point, and have a friend there who's waiting to work with me, see me, take me for lunch, take me for dinner, hang out with me, take photos for me, take photos with me, buy merchandise, whatever. I just got people there waiting for me." And they go, and I've known them because I've been there many, many times before. You know, I feel like I've got careers that live in so many different cities. I have a whole career that just lives in Chicago that I go visit once or twice a year. You know, I have a whole career that lives in Northern Ontario, Canada, that I visit once or twice a year. It's just like, that's what the road's all about. It's making those connections and everlasting friendships and just stories, man. I have so much fun on the road.
You see, that's the similarity between you, your granddad, and your dad.
Exactly.
Well, it's the same deal. It's great. Yeah, that's awesome. By the way, during the Bullwhip Johnson period of your dad's life, I actually know about the movie Blood and Guts, which is mentioned in your book. And I thought I was the only person on earth ever to see that film with William Smith as the
guy.
I actually enjoyed that movie. I thought it was okay. What did you think of it overall?
Well, I'm sitting here in my office talking to you, and I'm staring at the original poster for it. It's sitting right in front of my face right now. Mm-hmm. I made it. It's sat in a warehouse for 42 years, and I found it by chance and hung it in my office. And you know, William Smith, Michelle Lancelot, Henry Beckham, Brian Clark. I'm just reading over the poster here. But, you know, I thought this movie I had heard about my entire life. You know, back in the day when we filmed Blood and Guts, and that time we were doing Blood and Guts. And did your father ever tell you the time that we were doing Blood and Guts? And it was just this kind of, it lived in this fantasy lore space because I had never seen it. I had never any proof that it had existed. Just stories of a time of people who, you know, worked on it. Mm-hmm. And I'd always hear these stories of, you know, I've got it on an old beta tape, or I saw it on Channel 7 at midnight, you know, 2 years ago. And it was, it's again, for your listeners, the basic premise is it's a wrestling plot movie, but there's also a criminal element. There's also a kidnapping that goes on. It's just one of those kind of campy 70s movies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I remember my dad being so proud of it. Now, I had never seen it. And recently, a couple years ago, I had found this poster by chance in this warehouse in Stony Creek, Ontario. The story's in the book. I'll let you read it. But anyways, that night I was so determined that I was going to find and watch this movie. Mm-hmm. And someone put it on YouTube. They've since taken it down. I've gone back to look. But someone put it on YouTube in its entirety. And I watched it, and it's one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my entire life.
You think so? Really?
No, you know what? I think it has promise. I think it has, and conceptually, it's just, it was shot so hard and so fast with no retakes and whatever.
Well, that you can tell, yeah.
It's just so, you know, dirty, but I think that's part of the charm. And I mean, I love it. I love the movie. Don't get me wrong.
So do
I. It's one of the worst movies of all time, but I love it. You know, exciting.
But here's the thing about it, though. The wrestling part, they got it down.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, in terms of what went on behind the scenes at, you know, in a wrestling arena, I think they nailed it personally. And William Smith looked like a wrestler.
Oh, yeah.
Big, strong guy. I mean, I saw him in everything from the Stallone movies to he starred in an action film called Seven back in 1979. That's one of my favorite indie movies because that's another one that was thrown together for about 40 cents by Andy Sedaris. But it worked as a film, and I've always remembered that one. So, yeah, I kind of like Blood and Guts. I'll say it wasn't the worst movie I've ever seen, only because I have fond memories. And by the way, I saw it on Showtime originally.
Oh, wow. Well, I know it did well, you know, as a release. And you know what? I think why people like wrestling fans and people in the industry or people outside of the business, I think they realize that it really is genuine because, you know, my dad, my Uncle Randy, my grandfather, and the Love Brothers were all basically the creative directors on the film.
Mm-hmm.
Because this Hollywood, you know, people, they came together and they filmed in Hamilton and in Toronto and Paris, Ontario. They came with just kind of an idea and a script. They didn't have a ring. They didn't have a gym. They didn't have a bus. They didn't have access to wrestlers. They didn't have working wrestlers. They had a bunch of fight scenes. They had no stunt performers. They had no nothing. And they came to my dad and my grandfather and they said, this is what we'd like to do. And my dad and my grandfather looked at the production team and said, well, we can do all of that for you. Watch. And they did it and they put it together. And it was shot, you know, in a Hollywood way, but through the lens of working professional wrestlers, which I think gave it a whole other kind of panache. It gave us a whole other kind of sparkle because it was kind of a peek behind the curtain for that mm-hmm. time.
It was.
Yeah, that time.
Absolutely it was. I remember, you know, I think there was a blading sequence and everything. It unheard of for its time period when it came out.
Yeah.
And I think it came out around What's the year? Do you remember? It was late 70s?
Late, 78, 79. Well, I could see the poster, but it's in very fine print, and I don't want to get off mic here, but I know it was late 70s and maybe right. even into 80. But
And it had that gritty, small arena feel to it. You know, that's why I think the wrestling scenes and the wrestling perspective of it was pretty well done. I mean, you know, because I used to see my early matches in an armory, which was, you know, you kick the soda can away when you sat in your seat. One of those places, you know. So well, that, it was. It's like I think they nailed it. I really do, at least in that aspect of it.
Well, you know what? I think that again comes from a genuine place because they just pulled people in off the street into a dusty arena in Paris, Ontario. It was like a hockey arena that mm-hmm. they fully set dressed, but the set dressing was my grandfather's ring, the lighting they had, you know, the rigs they had that they used on the road for their regular kind of promotional tours. So it's funny I wrote it in the book, but Greg wrote this part in the book, found the information, but what they did is they just pulled people in off the street and told them that there was a wrestling show happening and they were filming it for a movie. So they were bringing in these civilians and people were going, I've been here for 8 hours. I got to leave. And what they were doing is they were giving away things like washers and dryers and refrigerators and other small appliances and giveaways and stuff to entice people to play or to stay. You know, mm-hmm. they'd say, film this one more scene and we're going to give away a refrigerator, and all the people would go crazy. You know, and they shot it like it was, and they shot it and they filmed it like it was a real match. Now, I wasn't there on the filming. Obviously, I was born many, many years later. But from what I understood, they just kind of worked out a match, did the match, filmed the whole thing from a couple different cameras. And that's what you see in the film. There right. wasn't a lot of, you know, edit points because they didn't have the time, nor did they have the money.
Well, if you compare it to another wrestling film of that era called I Like to Hurt People, they look very similar when it comes to the photography of the wrestling. And so I thought they did a nice job. I mean, yeah. say what you want about some of the plot elements in the film. Other than that, the wrestling part was spot on. So yeah. I've always remembered it all these years later. So. Well, how could it be, right?
You know, I mean, I appreciate you defending the film. I kind of say it's the worst movie of all time in jest because I had tried so hard to find it. You know, I had put it on such this pedestal in my brain of it's the greatest movie of all time. I just kind of went, oh, it's kind of like a 70s, kind of like a porno acting style movie with a lot of complicated dirty cuts and not a lot of rehearsal.
dirty cuts is the perfect term.
You know, and turn and burn, you know, and just keep moving on. But yeah, that's very interesting.
It was interesting. Well, anyway, so there's your granddad and there's your dad. So yeah. You lived a kind of a wrestling comeuppance into the world, but now you're on your own and you're making your way as a comedian. And how's it going? And I'll tell you why. I did a little research on you, and you're the real deal, man. It's some really cool stuff happening in your sphere right now. Tell the people about what's going on with you.
Yeah, there's a lot going on, Bob, and I appreciate the setup. I started doing comedy. I'm in my 14th year. And for me, you know, being as a kid around all the wrestlers, you know, life was always so crazy. You know, you had I wrote in the book, but it's, you know, very true. I had the bushwhackers swimming in the pool when we were kids, and they're coming in and they're doing whirlpools in the pool and doing the arms like the bushwhackers. And, you know, my dad used to work a lot of WCW house show events whenever they'd come through the Buffalo Auditorium. When my dad got inducted into the Elio DiPaolo Wrestling Hall of Fame, you know, mm-hmm. that was at a WCW house show. And that night I got introduced to, you know, the Big Show and Lex Luger, Macho Man, Ric Flair. And I was like 6, 7 years old, maybe 5. And so I grew up in this circus, like, you know, atmosphere. And I knew I wanted to be a performer and I knew I wanted to get everyone's attention. And so I couldn't become a professional wrestler. So I got into, you know, competitive dance because I wanted to get on stage. You know, I wanted to entertain. So I did that for 7 years. From there, I went into theater, did, you know, 16 plays in 4 years. And I fell in love with the stage in that way. And then I, you know, got into some film and television stuff, a couple of bit parts in TV shows. Then I auditioned for the Vancouver Film School. There's a point I'm telling you all this. Then I'm out in Vancouver and I'm doing some schooling at the Vancouver Film School, but I'm also doing some commercial work. And a classmate goes, hey, we're going to go check out this open mic comedy night. Now, I love stand-up comedy. I loved it growing up. My dad loved it. My grandfather loved it, I understand. We grew up in a funny house. The Comedy Network was always on our TV growing up. And I always, you know, knew that nothing made my dad laugh more than stand-up comedy. And I said to my classmate, I love stand-up comedy. I grew up in Hamilton. We got no stand-up comedy scene here. Let's go. And I walked in and I looked at this open mic comedy night and I looked at the stage and I said, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. And it was a very simple decision. I saw it. I found it. I decided the next week I was on stage. That was November 1st, 2010. And I have not stopped since. 100 to 200 shows a year. Traveling all over North America. I performed at the Comedy Store, the Laugh Factory. I headlined at the House of Blues in Chicago. I'm on my fifth national coast-to-coast tour right now from Halifax to Vancouver.
Nice.
I've opened for Russell Peters. I've opened for Sebastian Maniscalco. I've opened for Howie Mandel and Tom Green, Jeremy Hotz. You know, I've gone these crazy, crazy experiences and, you know, done some work down in your way. I, you know, sold out a small theater in White Plains.
Really?
Yeah, White Plains at the Westchester County Center.
Right.
I just headlined down in Morris Plains, New Jersey at the Dojo of Comedy, Tiff's Comedy Club. And I really love working the eastern coast of America. And, you know, I feel like in another world, I was born in the Bronx. You know, I love the style of comedy. I love the style of conversation. I love the accent. So I'm always trying to get down and work either between Chicago or New York, New Jersey, you know, all into that area. I just booked a show. I'm doing a show in Poughkeepsie.
That's near where I grew up, man.
Just outside of Hopewell Junction. I've got a show. Yeah.
There you go.
And you know, it's a lifestyle that I'm experiencing everything that my grandfather and my father experienced, but I'm not taking any of the bumps. And that's important to me. One of my very, very best friends in the entire world is a professional wrestler and wrestler commentator by the name of RJ City, RJ Skinner. And I talk to him every day. He's now doing very well over at AEW, and he's quoted heavily in the book as well. And he is one of those guys where he was a wrestler, but always wanted to be a comedian. I'm a comedian who's always wanted to be a wrestler. And we bond into that place together. And we've both kind of found this middle ground area where RJ is a professional wrestler, but he hasn't wrestled a match in many years. He's doing some very good comedy and entertaining stuff over at AEW. And I'm a wrestler son who's a stand-up comic who's never worked a match, but has somehow created this, this world where everyone thinks he's a professional wrestler. And all my merchandise looks like I'm a professional wrestler. And all my tours are billed like I'm a pro wrestler traveling across the land into territory. And I've really embraced that. And I've really said, hey, I'm the son and grandson of professional wrestlers. And we are from the School of Hard Knocks. And this is how we do things. And you know, I just go out on the road and, you know, I embrace their name, the Bull name. I always make the joke, my grandfather was Bull Johnson. My dad was Bullwhip Johnson. And I'm Eric. But it is funny, but all my tours are the Unstoppable Comedy Tour, the Undeniable Comedy Tour. You know, the book's called Run with the Bull. All my merchandise is, my clothing line is called Whipwear, and it's got bull figurines and Bull's Gym, Hamilton, Ontario, all over it. So I've really just said, hey, I'm not a wrestler, but I'm in the business. You know what I mean? And maybe that business is that I'm not taking any bumps, but I'm a kid. I'm a professional wrestler kid and I am a third generation sports entertainer without any sport involved at all.
No, you're qualified, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And I will say this, as on a personal note, I do like to attend entertainment events, and I will let you know that 75% of what I spend my leisure money on is stand-up comedy.
Oh, great.
I am a huge comedy fan, stand-up from from local Long Island comedians near where I live to the biggest stars. If it's funny, I will go. And you better come down into the lower 48 sometime soon so I can check you out, because it's like the little bird has told me that you are about as good as it gets up there. And I have to see it now. I want to be in the same room with you, man. I'm telling you.
Oh, I would love that. You know, are you on Long Island now?
I actually live in New York City, but I'm on like the border of Long Island and Queens.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So I know the area very well. I actually was just booking a show on Long Island. I'll have to give you the details, but you know, it's very interesting for me because I am probably one of the top comics in Canada. But in America, that means nothing. So like, I'm still coming down and singing for my supper down there.
You know, I had the same problem, man. I was a blues singer, and I tell people now, you know, in terms of recognition, I might as well have been playing polkas. Because it's like the blues community loves the blues, but you can walk down the street in a million cities, nobody's gonna know who you are. You know, it's just the way it works. But you're just a product of your environment there. That's where you are.
You know,
so do you have aspirations about coming down here and do a little more stuff just to, expand your territory, so to speak?
Yes, you know, I would love to. Again, it's a love for the road, but there's such a low ceiling in Canada. You know, we don't really have a star system. Our stars get created once they leave Canada. You know, all of our greatest assets go to America to become famous. And I'm pushing that point. You know, my wife and I just bought a beautiful house here just in Hamilton, Ontario, just outside of Toronto. And, you know, I'm very happy here, but there is going to come a point where I'm going to have to at least summer in New York City, or winter, either way. But you know what? It's funny because I go down to these clubs and they effectively make you sing for your supper. You basically have to go down and showcase, it's called. Mm-hmm. It's basically being a wrestler going out and working a match so the promoter can see you. It's the same idea. You know, but I'm going down to places like Detroit and they're giving me 15 minutes, and then I'm coming off stage and they're going, okay, yeah. You got 60 for the rest of the week and you come here whenever you want, you know, you do shows here whenever you want. So it's really, I've never done a show in the States without immediately getting asked to come back. It's
nice.
It's impossible. So it's hard, you know, with the advent of all the streaming services and Netflix and Amazon Prime and everything, you know, stand-up specials are coming out once a week, right? So this created this huge boom of stand-up comedy. So breaking in, you know, is especially in New York and LA, has become so, so difficult, you know, where I just basically effectively have to just show up and just keep introducing myself and, you know, trying to figure it out and trying to get noticed and trying to get booked and trying to become a star. And that way, when I already have a very, you know, successful career here in Canada. So, you know, that's why a lot of Canadian comics get a little cautious. They go, why would I go down there and start over when I'm already making, you know, all this money up here? Mm-hmm. But, you know, again, just like wrestling, you don't get into comedy to shoot for the middle. You know, you get into comedy to shoot for the top. You know, and it's funny, I went down to the Comedy Cellar recently. I was doing the show in Morris Plains, New Jersey. I had the afternoon off and I thought, okay, well, I'm going to do some Sopranos stuff because I'm a big Sopranos fan. I'm going to drive around, do some signings. And then, you know what? I'll go into the city. I'll go into the tunnel. And at night, I'll go to the Comedy Cellar. I go, I don't know anybody at the Comedy Cellar, but I've been doing comedy long enough. I might run into somebody I know. And I'll tell you, Bob, from the second I walked in, I must have known 10 comics. They're going, Eric, what are you doing here? I didn't know you were in New York. I go, well, I was in New Jersey, blah, 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 blah. They're inviting me to sit at the table and have a drink with them with these, you know, in this this place that I thought I would never have any connections. And I'll just show up and hopefully I know someone, and I know 10 people and they're all vouching for me and they're all telling, you know, the promoter how great I am. And oh, you know, his dad was a wrestler and blah, 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 blah. And that's a point of interest for people. So I tell all those stories, and I think it's more in front of me than I think it is. And I just need to take that jump and spend some time. And I hopefully you have a couch I can sleep on, Bob. I can come sleep on your couch
at popular prices. Yes, I do. no, I, you never know. I mean, you never know how these things are going to shake down, but I will say this, Mr. Oliver thinks you're hysterical. So if Greg Oliver thinks you're funny, you're funny. If you can make him laugh, you can make anybody laugh.
He's a tough crack, I'll tell you that. But yes, no, he does think I'm quite funny and a big supporter of mine. And you know, as we near wrapping up here, I know we're trying to change out subjects, but I just wanted to say, you know, Greg Oliver reaching out to me and writing this book has really changed my life. You know, because I originally saw this project as a documentary. I pitched a documentary around to Netflix and Amazon Prime called Becoming Bullwhip. And the idea was 33-year-old successful Canadian stand-up comic finds it's finally time to follow in his family footsteps and become a professional wrestler. Go out, do the training, work out a match, and in that process, go back and find out about all my entire family lineage and the stories and the places they have been and how I got to here now. So that was the idea for the documentary. Now I had Greg involved and I was asking for him for information. Long story short, obviously the documentary doesn't get made because I'm telling you about a story about something that I pitched. Mm-hmm. And it didn't get made for many reasons. One of the reasons was Netflix said straight out to me, we love this story. We love you, but you're not famous enough to carry your own show on Netflix. So I said, well, what would you like me to do? They said, just go out and get famous. And I went, okay, I'll just go out and get famous then. So what happened was is Greg approached me and said, there's book here, and he was right, there is a book there, and you've read it, and so many people around the world have read it already, and I'm so proud of it. You know, 275 pages of wrestling stories, again, you mentioned before, both absolutely hilarious while also being absolutely heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. You laugh, you cry, it's stories of victories and failures and pinfalls and monumental moments in their lives. And you know, and we also, as you read in the book, but for your listeners, you know, we also talk about mental health and addiction and losing a parent at a young age and how that affected me and my career and helped me become the man that I am today. So it's really all in there. And I really owe so much to Greg. You know, obviously this is his 20th book. The man has so much history in professional wrestling, and for him to reach out to me and say, hey, we should do this, you know, for a small fee, of course, you know, Greg Oliver, but we should do this.
I don't know what you're talking about.
For a small fee, of course, we should write a book. And you know what? I would have paid Greg $1 million. Don't tell him that, but I'll tell you, but it was such an experience. And I finally can say now I can put down these stories that I feel like I've been carrying around for 33 years and really focus on my own journey. Cause now all their stories have been told and I can just say, hey, here's my family history. Now it's time for me to start running. And that's why it's called Run with the Bull. It's a quadruple entendre meaning for a book title. You know, I'm very proud of it, and it became an Amazon bestseller overnight, and I'm just excited for everyone to read it.
Well, I want to get people in the lower 48 into this book. I'm telling you right now. And I'll tell you something else. Greg Oliver will not do a project unless he thinks it's super worthy to do.
Yes.
So the fact that he would come to you and say, let's do this, I think that speaks volumes to all the wrestling fans who are listening here, because they all know Greg Oliver's work.
Yes,
so,
sure.
And not only that, I want them to discover the book. I want them to discover you. I hope this little appearance here is a little stepping stone for more success for you, because I'll tell you what, you deserve it. I can tell from talking to you, you work really hard on everything you do. we haven't met, folks, but I can tell just from the sound of this man's voice, he has an urgency about him that I find most pleasing, because you know what? People who want to succeed. And he's funny. You're going to want to see this guy with a microphone in his hand. I'll tell you that much right now.
Yeah, I would love to. Well, I'll have to let you know when I'm down your way. But for all of your listeners, it's ericjohnstonwho.com. All my tour dates are on there. Everything you need to know about me, there's some videos on there. There's links to buy the book. There's, again, links to where I'm going to be next. And I know you got some old wrestling fans down in Florida, and I think I'm going to be booking a show in Sarasota, McCurdy's Comedy Theater, for all the American Southern Florida listeners. But other than that, I'm just going to keep showing up, man. I'm just going to keep doing my thing, and I got a lot of legacy behind me to carry, and it's giving me the fuel to make it to the next level.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'm a big fan of Canadian comedy, too, and I have fond memories of John Candy, Eugene Levy, Joe Flaherty, all the folks who came down here and made stars out of themselves. And I'll tell you what, I hope you're next on that list, because it's like we need some more imports from the Great White North, I think.
I think you're right. And I'll tell you, from my, in my hometown, you know, it's Martin Short and Eugene Levier from my hometown.
Is that right?
And yeah, Hamilton, Ontario. And I say in often in meetings and podcasts, and I'll say again here, it's Martin Short, Eugene Levy, and Eric Johnston. That's going to be the third on the list, and I'm working very hard to make that true.
Damn, Skippy, man. I like your attitude. That's great.
Thank you.
I am proud to have you on the show, and I hope this is the beginning of a friendship between the both of us, and I will be in the same room with you when you're holding the mic. I'm telling you right now. I am coming to see you.
Can't wait. I'll have to go. I'll add you to Facebook, and I'll tell you everywhere I'm going to be. Near you.
You got it, man. You got it. Anyway, folks, this is Eric Johnston. The name of the book, once again, is Run with the Bull, Three Generations of Sports and Entertainment. It is available through his website and wherever you buy books. Eric, it has been an honor having you on the show.
Thanks, Bob.
Well, that was a heck of a lot of fun. And I really want to thank the great Greg Oliver. Greg was the driving force in getting Eric Johnston to appear on this podcast. So it's much appreciated. Thank you very much, Greg. Great writer and a great guy. Just a worldwide treasure when it comes to wrestling journalism. Greg Oliver. Anyway, there's another show in the can. What do you think about that? We're perpetuating in a year or two now, heading toward April. And let's do the usual array of commercial notes here. They're not really commercials, just how to get a hold of us. And here's how you get a hold of us. If you want to write to the show, no cost, no muss, no fuss. It's outdatedwrestling@gmail.com. Just say a few words, and I usually respond back unless it's scary. But no, I'll write you back. I will get into a conversation with you. And I'll do the same thing on Facebook, too. I'm on Facebook. You can find me. It's just plain old Bob Smith. And you'll know it's me because I'm singing with B.B. King on the lead page of my Facebook area. I was a blues singer, you know, as Robert Charles. You can hear Robert Charles' music on Spotify and Amazon. Spelled C-H-A-R-E-L-S. Our official website, we listen to every single one of our podcasts, is outdatedwrestlinghour.buzzsprout.com. That's outdatedwrestlinghour.buzzsprout.com. Every one of our podcasts is listed there from one to, this is into the 50s or 60s now, whatever it is. And you can listen to them all. FOC. If you don't like using apps, you can go to that website every time. You can use that on your phone too. Doesn't matter where you are, you can get it. Although we are at every single podcast app. And we're also on YouTube and YouTube Music. So we is everywhere. Spotify, Google Podcasts, Podbay, Podbean, Podverse. Polly Want a Cracker. Oh, sorry. But we're virtually everywhere you can get podcasts. So we're not hard to find. We have more fun stuff coming up in the weeks ahead. I have something special about mid-year, maybe a little earlier than that. Something real special. And I've got some wrestler guests coming. I've got more people on the periphery of wrestling and more voices you may not hear everywhere else. That's what this show is all about. It's the Outdated Wrestling Hour, a fond look back at wrestling nostalgia through a different set of eyes. I was lucky enough to be in the wrestling business for about 10 years of my life, and I don't regret a minute of it. Actually, that's not true. We all regret some things we do in life, but this period of my life has been a highlight for me, and I hope it's a highlight for you every week as you tune in to listen to nostalgia, a few factoids you might not know, hopefully a couple of laughs along the way, and some very unique guests. We perpetuate, and we want to thank the members of our Outdated Wrestling Hour fan club for helping us out. You can find that on our website too, outdatedwrestlinghour.buzzsprout.com. For a nominal fee, you help with perpetuating this show, and I'll send you some articles and things that nobody else gets, just you guys. And on top of that, you can take part in, I'd say, bi-monthly Zoom meetings where we can all talk to each other in real time, face-to-face, ear-to-ear. Through the magic of the interwebs. So that's the Outdated Wrestling Hour fan club at outdatedwrestlinghour.buzzsprout.com. My name is Bob Smith, and I was fortunate to work with Bill Apter, Stu Stacks, Dave Rosenbaum, Craig Peters, Andy Rodriguez, Roy London, Al Bello. On the list went at London publishing, when wrestling magazines meant a whole lot. Wrestling magazines used to be the number one way to get information on wrestling you could not see because it was all territorial. Those days are over. You can see every federation at the drop of a hat or a press of a button. But I will say this. I miss the days of the pulp paper. What can I tell you? I had so much fun buying wrestling magazines in my youth, into my adulthood. I bought wrestling magazines until the day I started with the PWI company. There's no question about that. So I miss the mags. I miss the flavor. I miss the old times. But I don't want to miss you. So come back next week and every week after, will you? And please tell your friends. Drop a note. Send a message. However you talk to people. Let her know about the outdated wrestling hour with Bob Smith. We'll see you next time. And until then, remember, like Ringo Starr says, peace and love, brothers.